Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to things like wills and medical directives and planning for the inevitable, I guess is the way one way we could put it, with our guest, Ryan Zenk. Ryan's an attorney with the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. Ryan's an attorney and a certified financial planner, also CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. As we talk with Ryan, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about maybe writing a will or setting up a trust or maybe covering the cost of nursing home care? You can join the conversation. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Ryan Zenk, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. You're the managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. And the website for Elder Law Center says you and your colleagues are problem solvers. What kind of problems do you work to solve?
Well, it depends on the day, but generally, it's a big focus of our practice is families that have a situation with a loved one that has a long-term care need, and they're wondering how they can coordinate getting that individual good care that they're comfortable with, while not having to become entirely impoverished, you know, not having to lose all their assets, especially when there's a community spouse, you know, the husband or wife that's at home. So that's a big part of our practice. And then another significant part of our practice is what we would call traditional estate planning, wills, trust, powers of attorney. You mentioned advanced directives, that type of work.
I really want to get into pretty much all of that. You're also a financial planner. When's it valuable to turn to a financial planner?
Well, I think if you're planning on retiring, or you are retired, I mean, it certainly can be beneficial to get some advice. And there's a lot of different ways for folks to do that. Folks can hire someone who acts as a fiduciary, as we do. They can hire someone who's a broker. They can hire someone. A lot of places now, you can hire someone if you just want someone to advise hourly and just maybe once a year or every couple of years, sit down and take a look at your financial picture and if there's something that they would suggest. So there's a host of different ways that industry is evolving significantly. So,
well, it's not uncommon for people to not get their financial and medical affairs in order before they die. Why does that happen? I think I've had that experience recently myself in one situation at least, and I understand the reason for it, but it may be different from the reason that most people have to fail to do the advanced planning.
Yeah, well, you're correct, Larry, that a significant portion of the population doesn't have things organized. And I've seen it, I've been doing this for 30-something years, so I've seen it with people that are very financially successful, have significant estates, and I've seen with people, you know, that don't have as much in terms of assets. But and I think there's a host of reasons. One thing is it's not something that people often want to necessarily focus on. They don't want to think about the fact that, you know, we're all mortal, and it's one death per person per lifetime. And it's something that, you know, you have to do, but some people will just put it off. It's procrastination, not wanting to deal with it. In some cases, it's people are don't think that they have options, I believe, or they don't understand what their options are, so they simply kind of ignore it and leave for someone else to deal with. But it's almost always much more expensive to not deal with it than to do something ahead of time in terms of both time and expense for your loved ones.
Yeah. You're right about that. Amy in Holman has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Amy. Amy?
Hi,
what's on your mind?
Well, I was calling. I am 100% disabled veteran, but for general veterans or 100% disabled veterans in the state of Wisconsin, what do we have for, I believe we may have some sort of access to a free will?
Or what benefits, in somebody in like Amy's situation, what benefits would they have that might cover writing wills and that sort of thing?
Amy, I'm not familiar with a particular program for free wills for veterans, but there are there is the opportunity for anyone to work with some pro bono, both law firms. A lot of law firms will do pro bono work, and there's different community groups in Madison and Milwaukee anyway, where folks can get a simple will for free. So that's something that you can explore. I'm not familiar with something where the VA pays for wills, though. I haven't seen that. It doesn't mean it's not out there, but I have not seen that, Amy.
Yeah, there you go, Amy. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Cable emailed she's in her 80s, wants to sell her house and rent instead, essentially to get out from under the responsibilities of homeownership.
Sure.
Mowing the lawn and everything else. She understands there may be important implication should she need assisted living or nursing care in the future. She has what she thinks is good long-term care insurance. Are there other tax implications she should consider? So she'd be selling her house and moving to an apartment.
It depends on what the gain is on your house. As a single individual, you can sell your house, your principal residence, that is, and take up to $250,000 in gains tax-free. One thing to keep in mind, so that is the gain that you're taxed on when you sell your house is the difference between what you net on the sale and what your tax basis is. And if it's a situation where she was married and her husband owned the house, typically, depending on how they held it, but most often, she would have received what they call a step-up in basis when her husband died. So let's say they bought the house for $100,000, lived in it for 10 years, husband passed away, it's worth $200,000 at that time. Now it's worth $300,000. Her tax basis would be the $200,000, not the $100,000 she originally paid for it. So she could take that. She sells it for $300,000. That would be tax-free. In other words, the $200,000 basis, you can add $250,000 to that. If you're a married couple, you can add $500,000 to it, and it's tax-free.
All right. So those are the implications, Sue. Thank you very much for calling, and you can kind of do the math and figure it out for yourself there, I'm pretty sure. David in Red Granite, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm concerned with my property. My wife died 4 years ago, and at the time I did not put it into a trust for my three children. I want to know what the look back fee is as far as taxes and the like.
For gifting a house to your children?
Well, I'd like to put this into a trust.
Okay. Well, that gives us an opportunity to talk about this, David. Thank you for calling. Ryan, let's talk
about
this.
So I'm trying to understand. Is the house still in the wife's name and your name, or has it been moved over into only your name?
I have three properties that are in my wife's and my name, although I do have the death certificates. And I have one property that I inherited 2 years ago, which is solely in my name.
Okay. So typically, what people will do, again, you're going to want to seek a local attorney because it depends on how you held it jointly with your wife and some other factors. But typically, when one spouse passes away and properties are owned jointly, you want to file paperwork with the Register of Deeds in the county in which the property is located, and you want to have your wife's name removed from the property so it's solely in your name. That would be the first step, typically. But again, confirm that with local counsel. And then if you want to put it in a trust or if you want to gift it to children, you can do that. A lot of people are confused on gifting. A lot of people think you can only gift $19,000 or whatever the annual exclusion, whatever that is. And if you go over that, there's tax. There's actually not gift tax. As of 2026, there's no gift tax until you get over $15 million, and that's in terms of a gift. So if you go over the annual exclusion, which is $19,000, that's per donor, per donee, per calendar year. If you go over that number, you're supposed to file a gift tax return form, but there's no actual tax owed unless you go over the $15 million. So most people do not have a gift tax issue. Now, again, you need to seek counsel on that. There can be some problems with if you're going to gift property to a child as opposed to putting it in a trust. When you gift an asset, depending on how you gift it, most often that beneficiary, whoever you give it to, they're going to receive it and they're going to take it with your tax basis in it. So if they sell it after you pass away, they're going to pay capital gains taxes on the difference between what your basis is and what they sell it for. Whereas if you have it in a trust and then it passes to them when you pass away, most of the time is done properly, they're going to receive what's called a step-up in basis. So that beneficiary or beneficiaries can sell the property and not have to pay any capital gains tax on any appreciation that happened throughout your lifetime up through date of death. So there's a big difference for beneficiaries in terms of capital gains taxes.
Oh, and what if you've have a will and in the will it says the house should be divided among the two or three or four, however many their children there are. Can you get that changed? Do you have to write a new will, or do you what happens there?
So if you pass it through a will, the beneficiaries will receive a step-up in basis. But I'm trying to understand your question, Larry. You get it changed for what purpose?
Well, So if it's in the will, you automatically get a step-up in basis? Is that I'm thinking about the taxes for the children.
Yes. I mean, generally. I don't want to make a blanket statement.
Sure,
of
course.
Yes, the vast majority of times, something passing through a the beneficiaries will receive a step-up in basis, absolutely, and they'll be able to sell the property and not pay any capital gains taxes on appreciation that happened through date of death. Now, if the beneficiary holds it for another 10 years and it appreciates after date of death, they're going to have to pay capital gains tax probably on that subsequent appreciation, but not on appreciation through date of death.
I got it. All right. And David and Red Granite, thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Ryan Zank, founder and managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk wills, medical directives, and planning for the inevitable with Ryan Zank, who is managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, also founder and CEO of Family Wealth Advisors and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. So it's great to have him with us. Again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. And a quick note on Garden Talk, we'll be looking at new and emerging fruit and nut crops and with the author of a new garden book on tomorrow's Garden Talk. But right now, wills and medical directives and that sort of thing. And Christina in Glenwood has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a friend. She and her husband were married many, many years, 15, 20 years. They bought a house together. lived in it for many, many years. He passed away a year ago, and then she learned that her name is not on the deed. So what is the best way to handle this?
Well, I would recommend she sees an attorney who practices in that area. So, I mean, it's going to depend on what his estate plan said, you know, if he had one. So it may require, if the property was just in his name and he didn't have a transfer on death deed done, you know, which is something you can do in Wisconsin if you want to pass a house without it going through probate. It's a simple thing that folks can do, which sometimes is suitable. But assuming that that was not done, he didn't do that, and he passed away and the house was in his name, it's going to pass through his estate. So it's going to depend on what his estate planning document said. If he didn't have any documents in place and he passed away owning the house without a beneficiary on it, it's going to pass based on what they call the laws of intestacy. In English, the law who gets what based on what the state thinks the hierarchy should be. And in Wisconsin, we're a marital property state, so typically a spouse is the beneficiary. If there were children from a prior marriage, it can be different. They can be a beneficiary as well as surviving spouse. So there's different things that come in there. But the bottom line is, I mean, what you should do is set up an appointment, and you could probably do it at no charge for complimentary consultation. A lot of state plan attorneys will do that. And take in a copy of your deed, or the deed to the property, and any estate planning documents that your husband had, and go from there.
Yeah. Christina, thanks for calling. Well, this whole business, Beth in Cottage Grove kind of brings it up in some ways. She's asking a question about simple wills and estate plans. Why would you choose one over the other? Beth and her husband want everything they own to go to their daughter.
So there's a number of different options in Wisconsin in terms of how one can pass assets when they pass away. And I guess like a lot of choices in life, there's advantages and disadvantages of the various options. Some things like a trust are a little bit more complex and may cost more money up front because there's more drafting for the attorney, whereas something like a will may cost significantly less initially, but there can be a significant cost at the end, because if it passes through the will, it's going to pass through the probate process, which takes some time, and it takes about 10 to 13 months, depending on the county, Wisconsin, that the person's in. And it costs some money. There's court costs and attorney's fees that could potentially otherwise be avoided. Wisconsin also has some other choices, other options for folks. Married couples can sign a marital property agreement. If they put the right language in it, they can have everything pass and bypass probate. Another thing they can do is people can put beneficiaries on assets. As I said earlier, you can even put a beneficiary on your real estate now in Wisconsin. And if it passes based on beneficiary designation, it's not going to have to go through the probate process. And usually putting the beneficiary on it costs little to nothing. So there are a number of different options. And I think what's smart is to go meet with someone who focuses in that area and explain your situation. And there's a lot of, you know, different variables that come in doing an estate plan. Sometimes simple works great. Sometimes people are worried that, hey, if I just leave everything to my daughter, what happens if my daughter goes through a divorce 5 years after we're dead and gone? Is that money going to go to the outlaw, used to be the in-law? You know, how do I protect against assets going to a creditor of my child or a divorcing spouse or something? And the answer is, well, you can do that, but you have to think it through. You can't simply, if that's a goal, that's a concern, you can't simply pass the asset to the child and say, hey, I wish for the best. You can actually give your child an airbag, if you would, to protect it, if that's important to you. So there's a host of different factors. Sometimes people have children with special needs, and they don't want their children to lose any benefits they'd be eligible for. So you want to leave it to that child in such a way that they still qualify for available benefits, but what you leave them can also benefit them and doesn't render them ineligible. is an accountable asset, if you would.
That makes really good sense. Owen in Cornucopia emailed to ask if there's any way other than dying that you can get rid of a timeshare in Florida.
I'll tell you, Larry, I probably get offered about 50 timeshares a year.
Yep.
Yeah, that's actually a good question. The answer is yes. There actually are attorneys. I don't do that, but we actually have an attorney in our firm that has helped a number of clients get rid of timeshares. So yes, there are folks out there that will assist in that regard. I've heard commercials from some of them, so I think it's something you could probably search online and find someone. So there probably are opportunities for you to get rid of a timeshare. That's a common issue, quite frankly.
I wanted to bring up medical power of attorney, and we've had a question on this. It can be granted to an adult child or a friend or anybody, I think, to make health care decisions for a surviving parent, or maybe it's a brother or sister or whatever. And this, how important is this role? And I guess the question is, there are also, you see, if you go online, you can find, you can do this for free, and here's a form. And go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, that's right, Larry. Actually, the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney, and to the best of my knowledge, in most states anyway, the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney is available online, and it's a good document. So sometimes the online documents aren't necessarily the best, but the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney is available online. People can print that out, fill in the blanks, and you need two witnesses. It doesn't need to be notarized. And it's a good document. So absolutely, you get that free. You can also get medical powers of attorney at most hospitals in Wisconsin and most medical care providers. So that is a very important form for people to have. And you're correct. You can name anyone who's age majority to make medical decisions if you're unable to do so. And Wisconsin statutes require that two doctors, two licensed medical doctors, sign off that the person is not competent to make their own medical decisions. And then your agent's authority is activated, if you would. It springs to life. Now, in addition to a medical power of attorney, I strongly recommend that people also complete a HIPAA authorization. And HIPAA is a federal law. It has to do with medical privacy and some other things. But under the HIPAA document, which you probably can get that, I know you can get it online as well. It's not a state document, it's a federal. But you authorize people to be able to talk to your medical care providers, or say sit in the room when a doctor is talking about your prognosis or whatever. So it's important to also fill in a HIPAA form. Folks might want a particular child to be the agent under medical power of attorney, but they want all their children to be able to be present in the room. So you would want to complete the HIPAA form as well.
Okay, and on the medical, if you just type in Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney, that'll pop up, or where would you go to get the official one?
You can go to DHS, Department of Health Services for Wisconsin, and you can locate under that. But I think you're right, Larry. I think if you just type in Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney, it will come up. And it is important. It might seem like it's not important, but there's actually a cover sheet that comes with it. Make sure you print out the cover sheet and have that attached also. It should say something like notice to person making this document or something like that on the front. So there's a page that seems like it's not important, but it's actually in the statutes. It's part of it. So just make sure you print out the cover sheet as well as the pages that you actually have to fill in, names, et cetera.
Okay. And let's go to Sam in Madison next. Hi, Sam.
Howdy. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I got a question. Mentioned buying some land, and I'd expect to put it into a trust soon after. I'm wondering if there's a strategic benefit to buying first and then putting it into a trust, or asking if the land would be put into a trust before purchasing it.
Hmm.
Did you say putting it into a trust before you purchase it?
Yes. I'm wondering if there's a strategic benefit to having it be in a trust before.
I'm not sure how that would play out, how you put it in before, because you can't obviously put it in because you don't own it. So you typically will put it in afterwards. So with a trust, if you're going to finance the purchase, most financial institutions will want you to have it in your name when you purchase, partly because they want to sell that loan on the secondary market. So you would purchase it, if you're financing it, you'd purchase it, the lender would put a lien on the property, of course you'd sign a mortgage, and then you'd transfer it to your trust. So that's most often. Now, if you're not financing it, you're buying it with cash, you could put it in the trust right off the bat. In other words, you could take title, you could tell the seller that you want the deed to be made out, not to you personally, but to your trust.
Oh, so that's kind of a way. So it gets done right at the time of sale.
Correct. That, yeah. You know, most people don't buy properties with cash. Most people finance them. And typically when you finance, the financial institution will want it to be in the individual's name. That's not so much from a legal, it's more from a practical standpoint. They want to pool that mortgage with others and sell them on the secondary market. And so they want it, the mortgage they're selling, to show that it was in an individual's name. So you'd buy it in your name, you'd get a deed from the seller to you personally, and you'd turn around, you know, the next day or whatever and transfer it over to your trust.
All right, Sam, there you go. Thank you so much. Let's turn to Glenn in Merrill next. Hi, Glenn.
In an individual's name, so you buy it in your name.
Glenn, are you there?
To you personally.
Oh, he must have been not paying attention. Glenn, are you finally with us?
Thank you so much. Let's turn to Glenn in Merrill.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thanks for taking my call. My question is actually kind of twofold about a trust. What's the difference between an irrevocable trust and a non-irrevocable trust? Which one guarantees my house for my children to have if I go into a nursing home?
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that in this conversation completely for you, because there's a lot there, quite frankly. But I'll try to give you a 30,000 foot overview. So, as the name implies, in an irrevocable trust, something about the trust has to be irrevocable. Whereas in a revocable trust, typically whoever set the trust up, there's different lawyer words for the people who set them up, trust maker, grantor, settlor. Typically the person who set it up can change it, can take anything out of the trust anytime they want. And usually for example, for tax purposes, while that individual who set the trust up is alive, the trust is largely ignored. In other words, it doesn't have to file a tax return. On an irrevocable trust, There's different types of irrevocable trusts. There are trusts that are irrevocable trusts that have their own tax ID number, and there are irrevocable trusts that are treated like a revocable trust in that they use the Social Security number of the person who set it up. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both those. It's complicated, but there is the opportunity to go either way on an irrevocable trust. So, in a revocable trust, and this is a common misconception, I think, that people have, at least we see it a lot, where people think that they set up a revocable trust and they put their property in it and they think it's protected from a nursing home situation. It's not. It definitely is not. Whereas if the property's in an irrevocable trust, it may be protected. In other words, it may be that it's not a countable asset if someone has a long-term care situation. It depends on the trust, quite frankly, how it was set up. But you're going to want to speak to an attorney that specializes in that area, and you're going to want to specifically let them know that the goal is protecting that property if there's a long-term care situation. And so if you want to protect it from a long-term care situation, you're probably going to have to use an irrevocable trust. But there's significant variations in irrevocable trust, so you have to be careful. One thing in particular you want to be careful with an irrevocable trust is making sure that the beneficiaries receive a step up in basis on the property if it's an asset that can appreciate, like real estate, and making sure the beneficiaries don't have to pay capital gains taxes they could have otherwise avoided. So there are ways to set up your irrevocable trust so the beneficiaries receive a step up in basis. Probably the majority of them do not provide that benefit, but there are methods of doing that.
Yeah. I also was understanding when people try to do that, there's a time period. You can't say, I'm setting up an irrevocable trust today and then tomorrow get that set up and then tomorrow I'm going into a nursing home.
Yes, you're correct, Larry. So Wisconsin has a look-back period. There's a five-year look-back, and it's important to understand what the look-back is. That doesn't mean some people, I think if I gave assets away within 5 years of when I go in a nursing home, I can't qualify for Medicaid until 5 years has passed. And that isn't necessarily the case. It can be, but it isn't necessarily. So the look-back period is 5 years. It's always 5 years. And look-back period is this. When someone applies for Medicaid or family care or IRS, there's different Medicaid programs out there. But when someone applies for Medicaid because they have a long-term care situation, one of the first questions on the application is, have you gifted assets in the last 5 years? That's a yes or no question. If you answer yes to that question, then the state of Wisconsin gives you a formula and says, okay, you're ineligible to get Medicaid because you intentionally impoverished yourself. It's called, a lawyer word is a divestment. You made a divestment. And I don't want to get too much into the minutia here, but roughly, the current formula is, and this changes annually, by the way, the current formula is roughly for every $10,700 that you gifted, you are denied Medicaid for 1 month. And that doesn't start at the date that you did the gift, it starts at the date you apply for Medicaid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if 5 years or more has gone by and you apply for Medicaid, you can answer no to the question, have you made any gifts? And then that formula never comes into play, right? But if you answer, yes, I made a gift, then the formula applies. So a mistake someone could make is, let's say four and a half years have gone by since you made a gift of $200,000, let's say, okay? Let me use a simple number, $107,000. So 4.5 years have gone by. You go into a nursing home. You apply then. Now you're going to have 10 months. Take that $107,000 divided by $10,700. You're going to have 10 months of ineligibility to get Medicaid when you could have just waited 6 months and applied and you wouldn't have passed the five-year look back. So you actually hurt yourself by applying too early. So there's a lot to the Medicaid planning, but you're correct. There is a look back period, and equally or more importantly, there's a penalty period that can be opposed if there was a gifting done.
Got it. Brian Zenk, our guest today, founder and managing director of Elder Care, Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk wills, medical directives, and a whole lot more with our guest, Ryan Zenk, director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today. And questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. John wants to know, is listed as the personal representative in the will of a relative, and wonders what are the steps that he has to go through now that that person has died. I mean, he's got the will, and what do you, how do you proceed?
Sure. So the will has to get filed with the court, in the probate court in the county in which the individual was residing when they passed, and a petition is made to open up a probate. Most people typically are going to want to hire an attorney that handles probates to handle that. It's not required, but often advised. And once the petition is filed along with the death certificate and the will, the probate judge will issue what's called domiciliary letters to the personal representative. So that's the document, or that's the piece of paper that then gives that individual the right to gather the assets, deal with, you know, whatever the assets happen to be, bank accounts, real estate, whatever it is. So that's the first step, is to petition to open up a probate, file the will, certified death certificate, and the petition with the court, get domiciliary letters issued, and then the probate process starts. And again, there's a number of steps in it, and you can plan on it taking typically about a year. Sometimes it takes significantly longer than that. Depends on the nature of the estate and whether it's challenged and whether you go formal probate or informal probate. But that's the first step.
And probably a good idea to work with an attorney on that.
Generally, it is, Larry, just because it's hard for people to, you know, exactly what their steps are.
Yeah, absolutely. Got some information. We had a veteran call earlier wondering about free wills, and we got an email from Holly in Blanchardville, and she called to say there's a program called Wills for Heroes, and it provides free wills for veterans. So if you type in, anybody could type in Wills for Heroes, and you'll get a link to the service that's provided. So that's pretty good news. Good to hear.
Larry, I have heard of that before, and I think that's available for first responders as well. And I think that's through the Wisconsin State Bar. So I think that is, in addition to veterans, I think that's available for first responders also.
Yeah, as I'm actually seeing the website here, it's www.wisbar.org.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole string of four members / pro bono pages / wills for heroes. And so that sounds like a pretty legitimate thing to me anyway, if you're going through that step.
And the State Bar, the State Bar of Wisconsin, it can be a great resource for folks. If you want to find an attorney in your area that specializes in it doesn't matter if it's estate planning, if your dog bites the neighbor or something, whatever, you can call the State Bar of Wisconsin and get a referral to attorneys that focus in that area. In that area of practice that are located in, you know, proximate to where you live. So the State Bar of Wisconsin is a great resource for folks to use.
Carol in De Pere has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a will that was done about 20 years ago in Illinois, but I'm now a resident in Wisconsin. Do I have to have changes made?
To make it in accordance, in accordance with Wisconsin law. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, the answer is it depends. You don't necessarily, but you may have to. You definitely would want to have it looked at by an attorney that is Wisconsin licensed and practices in that area. So the answer is, not necessarily, but it certainly is possible. And some folks ask that question because it's a different state, or folks ask, you know, say my will is old. Do I have to, you know, do I have to redo it because it was done years ago? And my answer is the same. It depends. So there's a number of things that come into play there, quite frankly. So what you'd want to do is just probably get a complimentary consultation with a law firm that's near you that focuses in that area and have a conversation with them.
Yeah, so maybe an elder law attorney, something like that?
Yeah, or just a traditional estate planning attorney should be
sure.
able to handle a will, because that's relatively simple. What I would suggest you also do, though, is ask whoever you deal with, ask them not only, you know, should I change this, but ask them what your alternatives are. What other options do I have to accomplish my goals of getting it to whoever you want it to go to? Tell me the advantages and disadvantages of my different options, please. Because a lot of people, once they're educated, they find out that maybe a will isn't the way they want to go because, again, it has to go through the court system when you pass away, and part of that money is going to go to the court and to the attorneys that, you know, could have gone to your family members or charities or whoever you're leaving it to, Wisconsin Public Radio, for example, instead of going to, you know, for probate fees. So it's a, you know, I think it's a good idea to also find out what your other options are other than a will, and then ask about the advantages and disadvantages of your options.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Carol, thank you very much for calling. I think this has come up, but again, I can sort of re-ask it. Pete emailed to ask, how does land and or homes held in trust protect the assets from being claimed by a long-term care center? Also, doesn't a house get automatically passed to a spouse because it's marital property in Wisconsin? That kind of relates to an earlier call.
Okay, so the two different questions there.
Yeah.
So again, it depends on the trust. If it's a revocable trust, it typically affords no protection. If it's an irrevocable trust, it may protect the asset. And just for the record, there are ways to pass a house without spending money on an irrevocable trust. There are some less expensive ways to pass the house to intended beneficiaries. And have it protected from a nursing home situation. So there are other methods in the state of Wisconsin that you can employ. And then the other question was, doesn't it automatically go to a spouse because Wisconsin's a marital property state? Again, it depends. So a couple can opt out of Wisconsin marital property law. So you can do what's called, if a couple does a marital property opt-out agreement, maybe the house... the spouse doesn't have an interest in the house. You know, maybe there's a prenup that was in place and the house was brought into the marriage by one spouse, and it's their individual property and they have an agreement that it shall remain so. So it depends. Now, the default is, though, that it is marital property and that a spouse has an interest in the house, even if their name isn't on it. So, again, there's a lot of nuances to that. You definitely want to talk to an attorney about that. Sometimes people have blended families. I mean, there's a number of issues that can come up with that. So it isn't – you can't make the statement that it's automatically going to go to a spouse. That may very well be the case, but it may not be.
Sandy had emailed to say they've read that if a person leaves their timeshare to a beneficiary in their will, but the beneficiary never claims it, that is, it just goes back to the original company. Sandy looked into it because it seemed like a cruel joke to play on a beneficiary to saddle them with a timeshare.
Generally, that's correct. Generally, you can't force an asset on someone. They have to accept it. Otherwise, you know, think about it. If someone had a property that's contaminated, they could just deed it over to their enemy and their enemy would be stuck with, you know, a cleanup or something. So that's correct. You can't usually force assets on someone. They have to accept them.
Oh, man.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness for that. And Mike emailed to say his in-laws are retired, recently purchased a new house. Mike wants to know what happens if they pass away and more money is owed on the house than it is worth. Who takes on the financial responsibility? This kind of relates in a way.
The answer is the bank is, how do we say, shucks out of luck, right? Basically, so what would, depending on the nature of the estate or how the property was held, someone would, whoever has the legal authority to do so, would probably just sign a deed over back to the bank, or the bank would have to initiate proceedings to foreclose on it. So that's what would happen. The beneficiaries aren't going to be responsible personally for that debt.
Okay. I suppose the bank could go after the assets of the deceased. Or not.
It depends.
Yeah.
It depends. Very often, their only collateral is going to be the real estate itself. But it may be that they have authority to go after other assets as well.
Okay. James and Mellon, your turn. Hi, James. James, are you there? James says his... Have we got James?
I'm here.
Okay. Quickly give us your question. I guess we lost him. The caller's grandmother, okay. The will was done on a floppy disk, and they're unable to access it since. What can be done?
It's probably not going to work, but they could try. They can attempt. I mean, find someone that, where you could print it out and try to get it to a judge and have them accept it, but it's highly unlikely.
Yeah,
that the judge is going to accept that, a copy of it. And usually even, even a copy of a will usually isn't going to suffice. The original is typically necessary. Most judges won't recognize a simple copy. In certain cases, they can, so you could try, but the odds are that it's not going to work.
And there are, I see online, that we can handle your pictures from old, situations. I wonder if there's a company out there. I'd go online and check, can somebody, read a floppy disk?
Yeah, you're correct, Larry. There definitely are companies that will do that.
Oh, man. Well, we've covered a lot in the last 30 seconds. Is there anything you want to say that we haven't talked about?
No, I think it just makes sense for folks to, to make sure you get something in place, and rather than doing nothing, because, like I said, it's inevitable for all of us, and you're going to make it a lot easier for those who come after you in terms of estate planning, if you do something ahead of time.
Those are good final words, Ryan. Thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Larry.
Ryan Zeg is founder and managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, certified financial planner and attorney, also founder and CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. It's great to have him with us. Probably have him back down the road to talk about this again. And I want to thank you for listening. Thanks to our team for creating our shows every day. Our producers, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.